This is the Genuine Humans podcast, brought to you by Social Element. I'm Tamara Littleton.
And I'm Wendy Christie.
In our podcast, we'll discover the stories of the leaders behind the brands and the trailblazers who are making a real difference in our industry. We'll delve into how they got to where they are today.
And we'll hear about the genuine humans who supported and influenced them along the way.
Welcome back to Genuine Humans, and I am delighted, as always, to be here with co-host Wendy. Wendy, how are you doing?
I am also delighted to be here. Thank you, Tamara. And yeah, I'm doing good. How are you?
I have a feeling that I say delighted in every single introduction.
Well, that just is a great description of your general state of being in that case.
I'm also delighted. I'm very, very happy that we have got Rachel Moss joining us today. And Rachel is Head of Marketing Strategy at Allwyn, the operator of the National Lottery. Welcome, Rachel. It's lovely to have you here.
Thanks. I say I'm delighted too.
I'll be delighted.
And thrilled to get the chance to sit down and chat to you two ladies.
It's like when you post on LinkedIn and it's got, I am humble and proud, humbled and proud to receive this award.
It was such a joy.
I promise I'll mix it up a bit. Rachel, I want to start with what we love to ask our guests, which is, how did you get to where you are now? And also, if you want to just sort of share what you're doing at the moment, but just kind of go backwards to how did you get into marketing?
So, really by chance. So when I was studying my A-levels, I needed to choose a course to do at university. And I was studying French, German and economics. And I realised that I probably wasn't enough of a mathematician to do economics with French or German, which is what a lot of the university courses offered. And I came across this course in Salford University called Marketing and Modern Languages. And I was like, well, what is this marketing thing? And I was like, oh, it's about answering consumers' needs. And in my head at 17, I was like, I love shopping. Marketing sounds like the opposite of shopping. Maybe I'll give that a go. So yes, I applied to all the other courses you had to, but there was only one course that I really wanted to get on, which was this course on modern languages and marketing at Salford University.
I think that is very sort of single-minded, because sometimes people sort of, you know, fall into it sort of separately. So you had that ambition right at the beginning. And so tell me about what happened after sort of doing the course then.
Well, marketing is a massive discipline, and I think it's gotten even bigger in the last few years with the proliferation of media channels and the different types of things. So if you think when I started in marketing, CRM would have meant sending direct mails, and it's very, very different. As part of that course, I did a year out, 6 months in France and 6 months in Germany. And I was lucky enough to spend time in the brand marketing department of Guinness before, you know, at the point when they turned into Diageo. And I decided, oh, brand management sounds like the thing I'd like to do. So I was very lucky that my course allowed me to explore the part of marketing. So when it came to leaving university and applying for roles, I went for jobs that would allow me to look after part of a brand. And I ended up moving into duty-free on travel retail, as it's now called, to a company called Stork, who make Werther's Original and Toffifee, to use my German every day and to be a marketing assistant. And I was really lucky with that role, because the boss at the time, and I think there's, you know, great bosses help you grow and develop and move on within your career. He was really clear that the role within this company, if it's marketing assistant, was a 2-year job. And within 2 years, he'd either move on within Stork, which also owns Bendix and Mayfair, or you'd leave to move elsewhere. And when I also did a placement, worked in Berlin for Stork, and they offered me a job in project management, I was like, I don't want to be a project manager. I want to be a brand marketeer. And so therefore, I threw my net out into the wider marketing world and ended up with a role at Croft, which is now Mondelez. But it was only through Paul Ridgway, my boss at the time, going, as I went, oh, there's a job for this company. He's like, no, Rachel, you can do that later on in your career. Don't do that. Do this. He was really kind of going, you know, FMCG marketing grounding is a great place to start. Try and get into FMCG. And that's what I did. I took a 1-year contract at Croft. So there's a bit of a risk that they wouldn't renew it after a year. But actually, when I was, you know, what was I, early 20s, interviewing for jobs, and I kept getting rejected because I didn't have market research or I hadn't really done above-the-line advertising. But this role at Kraft, looking after their dressings and a relaunch of their dressings, would have filled in all the gaps of my CV in terms of research and advertising. So I took it, took risk, and I stayed there for nearly 6 years. So it wasn't all bad.
I love that. I love that.
If you don't mind, can we go a bit further back, even before university, and consider what you were like as a child and how that might have shaped where you've ended up in your career? So let's start by asking, what were you like as a child?
So I guess I'm a number one. So the first girl, I've got three younger brothers. So I've got that classic trait of being sensible and responsible and a goody two shoes. So I'd always do my homework and all of that type of stuff. But equally, we grew up, had loads, I've had a happy childhood, had loads of animals. So up until that time I was seven, my parents had a small holding. So we had dogs and cats and cows and sheep and pigs. So I was, you know, at one with, animals giving birth, but equally getting a cow butchered on the kitchen table. That also used to happen. So quite used to kind of the cycle of life. When I was five, on my fifth birthday, my three-year-old brother got run over. So me and my friends never made it to see Cinderella at the Panto, which my mum always said one of the reasons I never used to get on with my brother because he stopped me going to my birthday party. But that was probably, looking back, quite a big moment in terms of building resilience, because my mum at the time had my middle brother was still a baby, still a toddler. She had to look after him. Josh was properly in intensive care. So he was properly run over, you know, lungs, kidneys, ribs broken, all sorts of things, and was in intensive care for, I think, about 6 weeks. So I kind of was moved around. I spent time with my teacher to get to make sure I got taken to school, spent time with friends and family, spent a lot of time with my grandma, spent time, school friends. So I kind of had a period of my life where I was moving around. I can't really remember much about it. And I remember that there were lots of adventures because obviously I'd missed my birthday party because my brother got run over. So, you know, things were put in place to make sure that I didn't quite miss out on that. But that was a big moment. He's fine now. So don't worry, Josh made it through. And he was always more the danger one. So again, he climbed up in the tallest tree in school and jumped off and broke his leg. So, you know, in and out of hospital. So I was the sensible one. And then I went away to boarding school at eight. So, but I loved it. So really, really loved being at boarding school. And particularly as I got older, age 17, it allowed me to do things that no way my dad would have let me go to the pub at 17. Yet school did. Like, because my dad was pretty, very, very traditional. So, you know, he didn't drink. Interestingly enough, like didn't believe in gambling. Very, very straight-laced. And he even tried, in first career plan was to become vicar. And then he realised that maybe that wasn't the right thing for him. And ironically went off to fight in Vietnam instead. So he was a bit of an adventurer. So I spent a lot of time with him. You know, one of my favourite presents as when I was about seven was a pair of walkie-talkies.
It sounds like you had a really good support network around your family.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's what families do. And even so, more recently, when I had my son, unfortunately, I had what's called an amniotic fluid embolism and ended up in a coma. And when I went into a coma, people didn't know whether I was going to wake up. So again, that my husband had to create a network of support. So I think there is something within your life is having a few people around you who you can trust. And it's ironic, really, because lots of people, when people are having babies, think there's something wrong with the baby if they don't hear anything. Whereas actually, on our case, it was nothing wrong with William.
That sounds like an incredibly scary experience. I'm very glad that you're here with us and alive and well. So coming a bit more up to date and considering the people that you've worked with in your career, who have been the genuine humans who've really given you that support or influenced you along the way?
So, like I said, I think there's something about a great boss. So, in Kraft, brilliant boss, I had Marie Kirk, and who I met up when I went to New Zealand over Christmas, and had a really difficult meeting when I was working for her with the marketing director at the time. And she was like, Rachel, you know your stuff. Like, he was literally shouting at me across the table. And we went back in, and before we went back in, she was like, Rachel, you know everything. I'm going to set the room up differently. So he has to engage with you and I will sit out of the conversation so he can't engage with me. And actually, it sounds like it's a tiny strategy, but it made the most amount of difference because he couldn't avoid having the conversation with me and the meeting went really, really well. And I think I still use where you sit in meeting rooms as a little bit of a strategy to get the best out of things. So she was one genuine human. And then when I moved to Premier Foods, I went through a boss called Matt Hunt, who I guess uncovered the fact that I'm quite shy. I don't necessarily showcase what I'm good at. So he was looking for a marketing controller, and I kind of did the interview process. And he was like, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting this quiet person to be able to do the response to the presentation that you gave in the interview process, and became a massive supporter of mine. So I think there are those type of bosses who don't just be your boss, but also sponsor you throughout the business and make sure and help you connect with senior leaders make a huge difference. And then I guess as I've, and more recently, I was working in the National Lottery, my boss, Keith Moore, who sadly died a year and a half ago now, he was incredible in terms of challenging me, stretching me, but also making sure that the opportunities that best suited my skills almost, came to me. So I think there's something about a great boss. And then once you've got a great boss, then you can build that almost that wider network, encouraged from the conversations with other senior leaders or just stakeholders. Yeah, I think the biggest thing, one of the things I do is I mentor more in the Marketing Leadership Masterclass with Thomas Barta and Syl Sala. And the whole premise of that is about leading upwards, sideways, and your team as well as yourself. And I think people also underestimate your peers and the people you work alongside. And so, for example, at the National Lottery for many years now, my partner in crime has been Anna McAnally, who is an absolute creative genius. And she, I can make good ads, but she can make amazing ads. So there's a little bit about having that person who pushes and pulls up against you. And it's a person who can say, your idea's a bit rubbish. What if? And I think that as well has gotten me to deliver better work as a result.
I think there's a lot to be said for slightly more introverted leaders as well. I know, it's something that I'm sort of particularly passionate about, that we don't all have to be extrovert, loud leaders. There's a real strength in being sort of perhaps a bit quieter occasionally.
But what's interesting is people always go, oh, Rachel, you always speak up in meetings and you seem really confident. And my team were talking about, oh, what would you like to learn about? Well, Rachel, we'd like to learn about building confidence. And we use strength scope. And my strength isn't confidence, it's actually bravery. And it's what makes me go, actually, I've got a point of view here. I need to speak up and drive the change to see it through, not necessarily confidence. So I think there is that, just because someone is loud doesn't mean to say that they are confident.
Very true. Very true. And let's keep with the work theme. I'd love to know, obviously you were talking about your FMCG experience. How has that experience impacted on your approach to marketing now?
I am the biggest fan of the four Ps. Price, promotion, and place. That's how I learned about it when I was reading Kotler at university. But I think that's what a grounding in FMCG gives you, in terms of you get to manage the full P&L. You get to really think about your distribution. The fact when you are launching new products, you have to make sure that you've got those relationships with your retail suppliers. In the case of FMCG, that you've got the distribution in the retailers. There's nothing worse than falling out with a big retailer when you're doing a product launch.
Oh God,
that can massively impact it, but also making sure that your product is good enough to drive the rate of sale to keep it on the shelf. So, you know, a lot about, I'd say, pricing and place more than, it's a great grounding for every part of the marketing discipline.
And what's exciting you most about our industry at the moment?
Do you know what? I was really thinking about that. And you can say all the obvious. I think data is still a fascinating area and the power that data can unlock for marketeers in these days. And I think it's not just about data from your customers, but also data with inside the organization. You know, part of my remit, my team looks after, you know, the campaign delivery side of things as well as marketing strategy. And just knowing how many assets we're producing and what shifts we might need to make around the business because our product, you know, the amount we're producing has gone from X to Y. So I think data in its broadest sense is hugely important. And you could say AI, and it's absolutely going to make a difference. The other thing I think is fascinating is learning and development. And the fact that when I started out, you only really learn and develop, if you're lucky enough, from within your organization. Whereas now we have access to podcasts. There's loads and loads of free courses, whether it's Thinkbox TV Masters, or just lots of things out there. And also CMOs having conversations about what they've learned and what they've done that you can glean intel from to help yourself develop. And I think that's incredible.
Absolutely. You touched on sort of some of the ways that you approach work, and obviously you seem very kind of aware of your approach, but how would you describe your leadership style and how that's influenced your career?
So might be a bit cliched, but I'm an authentic leader. You know, I've kind of set vision and direction, but equally give my take on where those gaps might be. So sometimes when you're asking people to do stuff, you don't have the answers, they might not have the answers, and you have to find those answers together. So that's really, really important. And also personally, within myself, I want to be someone who makes a difference. So whether that's the organization I'm working for, whether that's the people I'm working with, and as I kind of progress to make a difference in the wider marketing community. So, you know, whether it's mentoring people I work with, whether it's mentoring through the Marketing Leadership Masterclass, and now having become a member of WACL, having that opportunity to help support women come up through the ranks of organizations. So that's a really, really important thing that is about being a leader for the job that needs to be done, but also beyond.
And I'm a fellow WACL member, having just joined last year.
Me too.
And so, yeah, and still getting to sort of grips, but it is so good to have a supportive network, and as you say, learning from each other and pushing the industry forward as well. So thank you.
So now we're going to move on to the part of the podcast where we get a little bit more personal and ask some quick fire questions. So let's start with, what's your idea of a perfect weekend?
I think I just actually had it. So a combination, or one thing's missing, my dog's just been spayed. So we didn't go on a long dog walk, but I did get to hang out with my husband and son, but I also got to have a little bit of shopping time with a girlfriend. So a lovely balance of both. I think, you know, weekends for me is either about spending time with, you know, family and taking time out, but also, if I'm being really selfish, it's about having a bit of me time doing things like shopping. So to encapsulate it in one weekend with the boys cooking a lovely meal in the evening, and that's what it's all about.
If you were walking on stage and there was an introduction track playing, what would it be?
So the last time I walked on stage, I walked on to Taylor Swift, Ready for It, inspired by my son, because on the morning of his 11 plus, he was blasting it out. And I was like, what a great way to just get yourself psyched and ready.
I'm going to jump in on the back of that then. Have you got a karaoke go-to song? Are you a karaoke fan?
So I love a sing-along, but even when I went to a bar in Tokyo where I knew no one and had the opportunity to do karaoke, I was too shy to do it. I've done a sunbox in London, but actually a karaoke, oh, too shy.
Too much. There's a whole sort of separate story where I accidentally realised that I was in a brothel when I was singing karaoke. I had no idea I was in Tokyo. The funny thing is that I didn't leave. I was still singing and enjoying myself and just hung out with the women and we all sang together. So there you go. So what are you doing when you feel most alive, Rachel?
I think just doing something I love, whether that's my job. And we mentioned when I was very sick after having my son. And when I got home, I realized I had my house, my family, and my job, and my friends. And actually, that's what really matters. So if I'm leaning into one of those areas, that's what energizes me and makes me happy.
How would your friends describe you?
So, confession here, I had to ask them, and they...
Good. That's the therapy bit.
So they said, lots of fun, gets very excited about things she loves, loves shopping and clothes and fashion, but equally is pragmatic and practical. And I think that's my child number one head side coming out.
How would you fare in a zombie apocalypse?
I'd win. Do you know what? I couldn't watch on TV. If I was watching it on TV, I would be behind the sofa or in the other room. But I have the same thing with blood and wounds. I can't watch it on telly. But actually, if it's there in front of me, I know how to deal with it and get on with it. So I'd win.
I love that.
If you could time travel to any point in the past or in the future, where and when would you go?
Oh, the Tudor court. Like whether it's the time of Henry VIII or Elizabeth I, I just think that was such a transformational, exciting time in history. You know, a little bit of Wolf Hall world would be fascinating, as long as I didn't lose my head.
Well, you don't need to worry about that because there's no consequences.
What is your favourite restaurant or food experience?
I'm very much a food for survival person. Whereas everyone else in the family loves going out to restaurants. So I do enjoy a good restaurant. I think for me, it's more about company. And when people come round, I'd rather we cooked. I don't cook, my husband does cooking. Something less complicated so you can enjoy the people you're spending time with as opposed to worrying about how fancy the dish is.
That's really lovely. It's been such a joy to have you on the Genuine Humans podcast. Thank you so much for being here. Before we go, is there anything that we haven't covered that, or we should have asked you, or I'll leave you if you have any closing thoughts?
Do you know what? When I was going through the list of questions, and I was thinking, it's the one about what would you tell a 16-year-old you? I was thinking, what would I say? And as I reflected it, the thing I'd say is, you probably won't have as many Jimmy Choos, I have zero, as the girls in the chicklet books you're reading about do.
And you're okay with that?
Well, I'm slightly disappointed. I did think I'd grow up and life would be a world of beautiful shoes and designer handbags. And there's a few, but not as many as the girls in the books. I do genuinely love shoes, but yeah, I haven't lived the shoe life that I thought I might.
You've been listening to Genuine Humans, brought to you by Social Element. If you loved what you heard, remember to rate, review, and subscribe.